Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
I'm a survivor of trafficking. That experience humbled me to my core and broke me.
When I step on the soil of America, I think of it as my land.
Of
course. Right? And to that simple effect, it makes you feel like I'm at home.
You know, and I sat in a ceremony, and it's challenging, you know. You're sitting there for over 14 hours, you know. You're sitting around the fire, and you're ingesting it in multiple different ways.
So you don't get to have alliance, you know, when you are part of the oppression.
It's the first time we were granted the legal right to have a relationship with Creator in our way.
Africa and the different countries can start building the future cities of the world.
Mushrooms are so special to me, to continue the deep ancestral healing.
We've really feared not executing.
Figure it out as we go. I need that type of energy. Let's just do it.
So you consider yourself to be a indigenous woman?
Yeah, Afro-Indigenous.
Afro-Indigenous.
Yes.
Can you explain to me specifically
what that means to me?
Right. What it means to you, or just what it means?
Yeah, I think for a long time I wasn't really sure how to describe myself. You know, there wasn't a box for me to check that really fit my identity. You know, my mother is Native American. She's also white. She's also Irish.
Mm.
She comes from both the Menominee and Oneida Nations of Wisconsin. So my grandmother is an enrolled member of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin.
Mm.
But my father, he comes from Mobile, Alabama, which is the historic Africa town. So that's where my family came from, was raised. So just that understanding that I have both of those identities, although I am Irish, right? With that, I don't acknowledge it, not because I'm not proud to be Irish, but my biological grandfather abandoned my grandmother when she was pregnant. So we don't know my biological grandfather, don't know that white side. So these are the identities that raised me. These are the understandings I have. And so I felt, you know, kind of liberated when I came to that self-identification of who Sutton is.
Mm. What was the tribe you said your mother came from? The Menominee?
Yeah, the Menominee.
The Menominee.
Yeah, so they're ancestral to Wisconsin.
Mm.
My grandfathers were chiefs of the Menominee tribe. So if anyone's ever been to Wisconsin, Oshkosh, Wisconsin, is named after my grandfather. Great, great, great. Seven-time grandfather. So that was Chief Oshkosh, the Brave.
Oshkosh be gosh.
Yeah, that's what everyone says.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't know if that's us, though.
I'm not going to lie. First, I thought you said the monogamy tribe.
Oh, monogamy. Well, I know they got, you know, tribes and communities around monogamy and not monogamy, but we the Menominee.
I thought that's how they got spread in the Western. Some people came from monogamy tribe. Some people came from polygamy tribe. I don't know.
Well, this is true, but no, the Menominee ancestral Wisconsin. We have been there for over 10,000 years. Mm-hmm. You know, what's interesting about my grandfather is he really walked in these two worlds, right?
Yeah.
And so with westward expansion happening, they actually wanted to forcibly remove us north to lands we would not be able to survive on between two warring tribes. And he understood that. And so it's interesting because at this time, we didn't have this concept of land ownership, right? We're stewards of the land. So he had to really learn this Western way of land ownership and capitalism. And through that, he was actually able to barter over 10 million acres so that we remain on over 235,000 acres today. We have one of the most dense timber forests in the Midwest. I mean, you can see our forests from literally, you know, the stars.
So what was the concept? Because when I did get to visit the Shinnecock Nation and I was speaking with the brother and he was explaining to me how, you know, he describes his dwelling. Right. Mm-hmm. Not a home that he owns, but a place dwelling. That he lives.
Okay.
Right. And I believe like that difference in concepts just of thought of the idea of ownership.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And he said that he was explaining to, I think, an IRS agent that wasn't familiar with why he didn't have to pay taxes. Mm-hmm. And she had basically came to his door, I believe. And he was like, well, the way he explained it was interesting because he was like, the sun, you know, rises and the sun sets. He said, talking about birds fly, there's stars in the sky and there are trees that we pluck fruit from. And he was like, that's why.
So we take care of this land. When we think about the world's biodiversity, right? 80% of it is stewarded by indigenous peoples, right? We know how to take care of the land. We are in relation with the land, right? So when I think about what's happening with like climate change and climate change mitigation, we're spending so much money to like funnel into like innovative technology. Not to say innovative technology is bad, but I think if we took that money and put it behind indigenous peoples who have had a long relationship with the land, know how to take care of her, we would be in a much better place.
Well, I think that's a, it's an interesting conversation there, right? You know, I watched this show, Yellowstone, right?
Mm-hmm.
I like that show actually, but it shows this battle of the land. Right. And this basically the show premise is this white family that now owns the Yellowstone land and it was taken from the Native American people. And of course, they're mad because they remember when it was their land.
Right.
And his family has had it for 100 years. So they've been fighting, killing, going to war to make sure that they maintain the land under their family.
Yeah.
Right. But it really reminds you of the presence of America, that while we may think of things as a history of hundreds of years ago, right? When you go visit the Shinnecock Nation or any of the nations of the Native American people, it's a reality for them now.
Absolutely.
Right? Like it's, I'm a living person, essentially displaced in my own home, right?
Mm-hmm.
Given rights and we have treaties and we have these things, but it's a history lesson for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's present day war for me.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this country is not that old, right? I mean, when we think about this democracy and we think about where it stemmed from, many could largely argue that it was taken from the Iroquois Confederacy, right? So I'm also Oneida. And so the Oneidas come from the Iroquois Confederacy, also known as the Haudenosaunee, right? And what that was six bands of tribes that came together during westward expansion in New York and in the North, right? Who had a lot of intertribal warfare, right? But understood that they had to come together, stop fighting. It was the great law of peace, we call it. And in that, they were able to create this confederacy, this democracy, right? And this, you know, understanding that decisions that were being made had to be come to a consensus, right? And then we also had our clan mothers. Right. Our
clan mothers.
Our clan mothers, right? And the clan mothers, which is interesting. So each tribe had a chief, right, who was on this council of the Iroquois Confederacy, right? And the clan mothers, their unique role is they got to appoint the chiefs. They also could call down the chiefs or replace the chiefs at any time if they were not being in alignment with what was agreed upon, right? So we really saw this balance of masculine and femininity, right? The chiefs lead, but the clan mothers decide who is going to lead and ensure that that chief is doing what he's supposed to be doing to be in kinship with the community, right? But when we look at history, Benjamin Franklin sat with the chiefs of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy.
Mm-hmm.
When we think about the U.S. Constitution and how similar it is to the Iroquois Confederacy, the only imbalance that we have is that they removed the Klan mothers, and that's what you see today. But I say all that to say the United States is not that old.
Yeah.
We predate, you know, these laws and these ways. We have our own protocols.
Yeah, no, the United States is definitely new, but it's built off, you know, indigenous science. Right?
Yeah.
The flag of America, the tribes,
the
states.
Look at the dollar. We the people. That's what indigenous, we call ourselves we the people.
The teams.
We the people.
Of America.
The mascots, I mean.
There's so much about America that we don't realize, you know, that come from Native American origins.
Oh, my gosh. Look at so many of the names of states and cities. Mm-hmm. You know, once you get to really understand, you know, indigenous ways and being and even just the cultural understanding from some of the tribes you might, you know, see in different states, then you get to see like, oh, like, for example, you know, in Wisconsin, Milwaukee, like, that's very much so an indigenous name, you know. But yeah, I think because of all the erasure we've experienced, right, through the genocide, through boarding schools, you know, today I shared, you know, my third grandfather, Chief Reginald Oshkosh, the second Chief Oshkosh, was the first to go to a boarding school. He was sent to Carlisle Indian Boarding School out in Pennsylvania, where that mantra is kill the Indian, save the man, you know? And so right now, right, so many people are reclaiming what it means to be indigenous. And I think there's a lot of, you know, advocacy to revitalize indigenous knowledge. And so people are starting to talk about it more, or starting to understand like, oh yeah, that name, that definitely came from a tribe, or, you know, some of these customs or some of these things that I see, whether it's the flag or whether it's the dollar bill, you know, that eagle is sacred to us.
And I think there's the real lost connection of in history in America. I think our perception of the past, you know, is European, right? And it has been whitewashed to an effect that we don't really appreciate our beginnings here in America, right? Because, you know, there's the old conversation of our ancestors, you know, they had the conversation, are we black or are we African-American, right?
Well, they rename us every 20 years.
Yeah. And, you know, some people, they swear they would never be called African-American, right? Because they believe that it didn't really speak to the infinity of their soul and who they were. And then, you know,
Native
you look
American,
at
American, right?
Yeah, Native. But look at Ghana. Look at Nigeria. America, we've been in America longer than those have been established names for those countries, right? So if a one can call themselves Ghanaian or one can call themselves Nigerian, then I don't think that you have the power to strip black people away from being Americans, number one, because the America itself is an operation, right? That was, you know, innovated by us partially, right? And worked by us, right? Built off of us, our ideas. There's so much that was stolen that we don't even know that if we were given credit for, we would appreciate.
That's right.
Right. So when, you know, when I step on the soil of America, I think of it as my land.
Of course.
Right. And to that simple effect, it makes you feel like I'm at home. Right. Mm-hmm. And then I step out of America. And I say that because if when I go to Africa, I have to learn the culture of Africa.
Right.
And the culture of Africa is separated by tribes as well.
That's right.
There's tens of thousands of them. So for me to just say African, that's like me saying I take on every aspect of all tribes, but with ignorance because I don't know none.
Well, it's because we're not a monolith, right?
Which we should be.
Well,
monoliths are powerful.
Well, I think in some ways, yes. But I think when I, in consideration to indigenous peoples of the Americas, Turtle Island, right? We don't want to be seen as a monolith because we have so many different cultures and cosmologies and protocols and ways that are true to this tribe, right? Are there similarities that we all share? Absolutely. There are so many different principles and protocols that we all can be in deep alignment and agreement with. But each tribe you go to, it's going to be a very different experience to the foods we eat, to the gods we pray to the traditions we carry, to our ceremonial practices. Right. You know, and so I think, yes, I think to break down silos, yes, very powerful, you know, but to be a monolith, I think is being complicit with erasure.
I think a monolith in an idea of there has to be a level of oneness that unites us all.
Yeah, I agree.
Because there's the individual mm-hmm. and what the individual likes, right?
Yeah.
You can have your values, your customs, what is your taste level, what are your traits, what is customized to you? Mm-hmm. In the world now, we find our tribes, right? Mm-hmm. People that we like, people that like the same things, mm-hmm. people that have the same perspective, judge things, feel things, see things the way we see them.
Yeah.
That's my tribe.
Yeah.
Right. Even in places where people are under what we see them as monoliths. Right. Mm-hmm. They still have their tribes in that. Right.
Absolutely.
I think we think of it as like a separating factor, but it's not. A tribalism, I think, is natural. Right. In the sense that you find peace in people who are like you.
Yeah, as humans and having a human experience, yeah. we don't want to be isolated.
Yeah.
You know, that's not a setting in which we thrive, right? It's the interconnectedness that helps us really be in our power, in our health, in our wellness, right? And that is kinship, right? It's one, the interconnectedness of all things, not just people, right? It's mm-hmm. the inanimate and animate, right? It's the plant medicines, the four-legged, the winged, the two-legged, right? But yeah, I think, you know, and I think even with plant medicine, people feel kinship for the first time, right? Mm. They feel that oneness, and they also feel that connection to everything around them, especially people. And I think, yeah, community is so important. Kinship is so important. Your tribe is so important, mm-hmm. right? But I agree. I think, yeah, we are so much stronger together than we yeah. are in silos.
And that plant medicine, I think that's where things become so much, like you said, it becomes so much more of a one, because you realize you basically strip down all of the things that you put on. Mm-hmm. And in that, you're not speaking from an egoistic standpoint.
Yeah.
It's like a soul meeting another soul.
That's right.
Now, you can have a conversation with that soul, like, you know, how I see how you dress your avatar up.
That's right.
You know, what system of belief have you chosen on this realm?
The 3D.
Right?
Right.
But you're doing it from a different state of awareness.
That's right.
But because, you know, I wear the color red, you wear the color orange. Now I'm a red man and you're an orange man. Cool. Now we're saying, hey, we're different people. And it's like, we've chosen this.
Oh my gosh.
Because it flows with our soul and our spirit for one reason or another.
Yeah, I agree. I think there are so many different assumptions and biases that we operate mm-hmm. based on how we've been conditioned, right? What society has told us, what is right, what is wrong, who we should be in kin with, who we shouldn't be, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think plant medicine helps you, like you said, remind yourself that you are a soul, right? Mm-hmm. In this physical body.
Yeah.
But what's more important is being able to connect with those around you to be able to delve in deeper, to be able to reach this higher consciousness, right? And that's the key to self-actualization, which is built on the foundation of community actualization.
So, because you mentioned plant medicine a couple times.
I did.
So,
I love plant medicine.
So, what is your selection of plant medicine that you intake and go on your journeys with?
Yeah, mushrooms are so special to me. I was introduced to mushrooms when I was about 20 years old after surviving horrendous gender-based violence.
Gender-based violence?
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm a survivor of trafficking.
Okay.
And that experience humbled me to my core and broke me like nothing else in this lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
I did not know how to pick myself back up. At that time, I was getting a degree in psychology when that happened to me, which is why I also say that these things can happen to any women. You know, sometimes you don't recognize the signs or, you know, how you're being groomed. And so in that experience, you know, I was saved, and I'm so thankful that I was saved out of that situation. But again, I came back into my degree after that, and I was doing the typical cognitive behavioral therapy. You know, I was going to ceremony, more so like powwow, just being with my community. But I was still hitting this like brick wall, right? And I remember this assignment that I had, which was a genogram assignment, right? This pictorial display of your family tree. And you have to annotate the different adversities they've been through, whether it's their health or, you know, their emotional health, right? Whether they had an abortion or they were murdered or they, you know, experienced rape. So I had to go through all of these generations ask really difficult questions. And I remember sitting on the floor with this big piece of paper and seeing these cycles perpetuate from contact with settler colonization and boarding school. And then I saw me, right? And all of the things I had experienced and understanding that, you know, a lot of these traumas didn't begin with me, but I embody them and I can perpetuate them, you know, unconsciously. And not wanting to be there anymore, not wanting to be a victim, wanting to be a survivor, wanting to be a warrior. And so one of my good friends, you know, I was a researcher beginning my research at the time. I'm still a researcher, but beginning my research in acculturation and how that affects mental health and academic performance. And so he knew that the key to me wanting to do something would be through research. And so he shared to me all of the different, you know, just research studies that they'd done around psilocybin. And he showed me all of the propaganda that the government had tried to use to disconnect our cultures from these plant medicines, because mushrooms aren't a medicine that come from my communities, being Menominee and Oneida. But there are different plant medicines that, you know, my communities have sat with,
like
peyote being one. Yeah. The Native American church influenced so many different tribes and shared those traditions everywhere, right?
The Native American church, you said, influenced those traditions?
Yeah, but they passed them on, right? Well, not the Native American church, but indigenous peoples, right, who had sat with that medicine for time immemorial. Then they had to form the Native American church because of the propaganda within the United States. But then
how does the Native American church fit within the structure of influence of, like, decision-making within indigenous peoples?
They are their own entity. They have exemption through the American Indian Religious Freedom Act to be able to sit with peyote because it is illegal in this country. And so if you want to sit with peyote legally, you have to be a member of the Native American church. And so there is a Native American church in Wisconsin, and they were able to share those practices with the Menominee and other tribes, right? My auntie has told me stories about, you know, her grandfather, you know, having the bundle and not passing it down, right? And that is largely because of settler colonization, boarding school, where we were literally told to cut our hair, not speak our language, beaten if we spoke our language, and the regalia was taken, and, you know, these shirts and pants were put on us, right? But yeah, so, you know, going back to just this mushroom experience, for me, it was the first time I really could feel the historical and intergenerational trauma flowing through my blood. But I also felt like the strength and resilience of my ancestors being both Black and Native, right? And just understanding the power that I truly had within myself to be able to be the first in my family to say, no more. You know, this ends with me, right? And we're going to create a new pathway for our future seven generations. And that principle right there, the seven generations, comes from the Haudenosaunee, right? The seven generation principle is this understanding that we have a responsibility to make every decision within sustainability, understanding that it will have a ripple effect to the seven generations. So then every time we're thinking about a decision, you know, while we're being strategic in this world, like, how are we considering, you know, the youth, right? How are we considering the ancestors who came before us, right?
I like that. I like that. So I wanna dial in a little bit on peyote. What is the experience of peyote? Is it peyote or peyote?
It's peyote.
Peyote. So what is the experience of peyote, and what is its form and intake?
Yeah. So peyote can be ingested by eating the plant. There's teas that are created. There's also powder forms. Depends on your, you know, ceremonial leader, your peyote roadman, and how they're conducting that ceremony. I was invited in a very respectful way to sit with peyote. And it is, for me, it was this experience where I think, you know, with mushrooms, you take the medicine, you're on the rocket ship, it's going to take you where you got to go, even if you're not trying to go there. It's going to take you there, you know, which is beautiful in itself. Sometimes you're not, you don't know where you need to go.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. But with peyote, there's a subtleness where you can get in the car and kind of drive to where you want to go. It's really this heart opener, I would say.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and I sat in a ceremony, and It's challenging, you know. You're sitting there for over 14 hours, you know. You're sitting around the fire and you're ingesting it in multiple different ways. But I think for me, it was just, it helped me to continue the deep ancestral healing that, you know, is my responsibility right now. But I will say, you know, the Native American church and a lot of, you know, traditional peyote people are pleading for community to not ingest peyote right now. There is a huge ecological threat to peyote right now, and there is not enough peyote to feed the current members or traditional people that have this medicine as their sacrament, right? So an alternative to peyote could be San Pedro, where you can get San Pedro anywhere. You know, if you're in California, you probably see San Pedro growing, you know, down the sidewalks, right? You go to Menards, you can buy San Pedro, you know? So I think it's also understanding that there are also sustainable solutions and how we choose the medicines we're partaking in to be in deep respect to the medicine, to the land, and to the people.
You know, when you speak about plant medicine and many people that come from the culture.
Yeah.
They always speak on it with such reverence and respect and honor. Mm-hmm. You know, what is that relationship where you speak on it as if you're talking about a member of the tribe?
It is. It is. And this is going back to kinship, right? It's understanding that these plants are our relatives. You know, I have an elder and someone I really just look up to, Sander Ironrope. And he has said so many times, that's our grandpa. That's our grandma that you go and just pick out of the ground without permission, right? That's our grandmother or our grandfather that you just extract from for your compound and your molecules to create synthetic, right? You're taking from us, you're extracting from us, you're exploiting from us, right? So when you have this mindset of kinship and really center the interconnectedness of all things, you have a deep reverence for plants, for the land, because you understand that they're living, breathing entities that teach us. They teach us so much, right? So they deserve that deep care.
I think what's very admirable is the relationship and connection that indigenous people have with the earth, Mother Nature, the elements, which is something that's vastly lost today in society, right? There's an honor of the wind, there's an honor of the sun, there's an honor of the earth, there's an honor of the cycle of the times to the plants, to the insects. And there's this constant way about being in flow with the earth and the rhythm. And that's something that anytime I even hear, whether it's on a movie or whether I'm watching a documentary, there's even a flow, like in the way that indigenous people speak, right? That it feels as if you're talking to an ancestor presently, right? And then there's this pace that we have in English, right? And this pace is a much faster. It's urgent. Like you're trying to get to a point. And theirs is a much slowed down and more so moving and flow and direction, because it doesn't seem like you're trying to get a person to a point. Because the problem is that, you know, I'm very masculine and logical in my thought pattern.
Yeah.
But you realize that, you know, nature is created to flow. It's not created to end. And logic allows you most of the time come to an end conclusion. Right. And then you settle in that thought. Yeah. Right. And this is where even when you talk about creating cycles, right, and sustainabilities, it's coming to a point of having a relationship with everything.
Yes.
And there's a way about going in that relationship that you're not taking more than you need. Right. And so you're not robbing. You're actually helping if you're doing it correctly. It's kind of like, you know, and this may not be the greatest example for you, or but still, I think it is. It's like when a person, some people go and hunt and kill deer that may overrun as a population so that it doesn't, you know, mess up the forest.
I come from a family of hunters.
I believe that's
how we take care of the land, right? But we use every part of that deer, right? And I think, you know, it's funny you said we don't take more than we need, because that was a teaching that that came from, you know, my seventh great grandfather, Chief Oshkosh, because he's literally the teacher of sustainable forestry, right? His practices are why our forest is so dense. People come from all over the world to study our forests and our forest management practices, right? And it's tied into sustainability. It's tied into this kinship. It's tied into the seventh generation. And these really are the three principles that rule my entire life, you know? And I have so much to learn. I am a sponge right now. My eyes are just opening in an amazing way. But I know wherever I go on this path and whatever decisions I have to make or whatever tables I'm sitting at, these are the things I'm constantly going to remind myself of.
I wanted to dial back again to Indigenous people. And what does that mean?
Yeah. So I think, you know, largely Indigenous to me means being Indigenous to the land, right? Having a relationship with the land in which you come from, right? There are so many Indigenous peoples all over the world. And I think when people hear Indigenous, they just think North America, Turtle Island, Native Americans. But there's Indigenous peoples everywhere, you know, in Africa and Sami and New Zealand and Australia, you know, we're deep, right? And I was a part of the United Nations Global Youth Caucus for the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. And I'll never forget this moment. It changed my life. I think I was like 22, well, 8 years ago, aging myself, but we were sitting in the circle, and it was after one of the forums ended, and it was Indigenous youth representatives from everywhere in the circle. And we went around the circle to just share what we were holding, what our hopes and dreams were for our future generations, and what were some of our fears. And we cried together, you know, we cried together. But what I understood after that circle ended is that we have so much more in common than we have, you know, differences. And once we realize that, the power we hold as Indigenous peoples globally, oh, we could shake something for real, you know? Yeah. And we can't rely on something like the United Nations that's built on this bureaucracy to do that, right? And so that's a dream of mine, to really support bringing all Indigenous peoples together. One of my relatives, Ingrid Washiwatok, Flying Eagle Woman, was one of the most well-known Indigenous rights activists of the 21st century, did so much work within the United Nations and in philanthropy. Unfortunately, she was kidnapped and murdered by the FARC guerrillas in 1999. But what one of her legacies really was bringing the Indigenous peoples of the North and South together. And I really see this opportunity to bring all Indigenous peoples together, right? Of every part of the world, every corner, so that we can really demand land back and really enact our sovereignty in a powerful way.
So what are some of the challenges? Well, two parts. What are some of the challenges and the rights that Indigenous people face in America, right? Is it possible that someone can be Indigenous to America and not know? What are some of the systemic things that they have to deal with that we may not be aware of as, you know, everyday people?
Yeah.
Because I know that, you know, the common thread of thought is there's always these mental health issues. There's alcoholism, there's drug abuse, there's suicide, there's kidnapping.
We have the worst health outcomes out of any race, any ethnicity. That's very true. But other thing, you know, and that's everyone hyperfixates on those things, and they are true, and it is important that we highlight that, and we, you know, have the economic resources to be able to create the programming to support that. But on another level, what, you know, I don't think a lot of people are thinking about is the war that we have, or the issues we have between our tribes and the government, right? Because we are alien to the United States. We have our own sovereignty. Right. We have our own government, right? We don't have to adhere to the state law, right? We adhere to federal.
Yeah.
So if there is a federal crime that happens, you know, on a reservation, you know, the FBI comes, right? That's what happens. And I think really understanding that we are always fighting for this government to honor the treaties they've signed, right? And I see these treaties as this, you know, sacred bargain. Really, was it a bargain? I don't know. I mean, one could argue it really wasn't that. But, you know, and there were things we were promised, and we're constantly having to go back and say, look, You know, we have this right to this land. We have this right to our ways. You know, even when we think about our health care, right? If you are Native American in the United States and you are enrolled in a federally recognized tribe or a state recognized tribe, or you are a descendant, the first, second, or third degree, you are born with free health care through Indian Health Service, also known as IHS, right? A lot of people don't know that. And it's similar to like the VA structure, like universal. And what's interesting about that is that this is a treaty, and the treaty said we are going to provide that free healthcare. Today, IHS is funded at 50% of its capacity, has always been grossly underfunded. They have never funded it to 100%, right? So when I see all this money going so many other places and not staying here to take care of the commitments you have made to indigenous peoples of the United States, I'm beside myself.
Yeah, well, you know, they funding wars.
They are funding wars
for countries that have founded themselves the same way America has.
Well, that is how settler colonization continues to perpetuate itself and tries to continue to marginalize us. But I think there are, you know, are unique opportunities that we have right now and the innovative technologies that are coming to the forefront, how we can reimagine, you know, capitalism or wealth and reinvest in our communities.
So what is that future right now? Because I look at the sovereignty that you do have and the opportunities that can come with that. And what are the challenges of utilizing that, right? So that you all can have self-sustainability and create your own. Because, you know, from the outside looking in, a person don't understand the, I guess, challenges of why not start with what you have, right? And I know when, you know, from a little bit of knowledge that I do have on the subject, there's sometimes a lot of conflict between the elders and the youth. Youth want to make a change, and the elders is like, nah, I'm not ready for that. Then there's usually somebody who is a little more, you know, vocal, and they going out for it, and you got to wait for things to shift, and there's all of these in-house things. And so it's the stifle of progress. So is it more the challenge of the government, or is the challenge of the self-government, the tribe system, right? Not allowing these things to operate in what would be the modern day indigenous innovative ways of going about creating self-sustainable systems?
Yeah, well, when we're talking about self-determination, one would think that would be simple, but yeah, it's completely nuanced. There's so many layers within that. And it's a really good question. Like, is the issue with the tribal to government relationship or the is it intertribal issues itself, right?
Because there's the, even in, you know, in our cultures that are fighting from or maintaining self-identity, right? But then at the same time, wanting to move forward, there's always this perseverance that has to happen. But, and also why we say old man for wisdom, young man for war, right? And so it's like there has to be this let go, right? But it has to be in trust that you're not letting go of it. You're actually passing it forward.
Well, this is what I call the gatekeepers, right? I think there's a difference between an elder and a gatekeeper, right?
Talk to
me about it. You know, the gatekeeper, you know, isn't ready to really center humility. Isn't ready, ready to let go, right? Isn't able to have that empathy or perspective that you were once that youth that was hungry to innovative ideas. Some, you know, gatekeepers who are elders have this mentality of this is the way it's always been, so it has to be like this. And then we come in with innovative ideas and new strategies, and we're like, well, why don't we think about it in this way? Or, you know, and we start kind of moving the needle, and there's resistance.
There. I've always been an innovative, rebellious, revolutionary youth that's trying to push constant change,
but
for the better.
But they need education, you know? Yeah. And we also have to have some humility and understanding that a lot of this is happening so fast and so new to them. And so I think having that compassion for them.
But where's that warrior spirit? Well, we got to kick y'all in the ass and be like, all right, y'all got to stop holding it. We already got an enemy out there.
Yeah.
We don't need another one here.
No, it's true. But right? We also have to honor the respect. And also,
absolutely,
there's so much work that they didn't. It's a privilege that we get to heal in this way.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have that privilege, right?
But that's, I feel like, and I 100% understand. Yeah. And that's what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
It's not supposed to be a punishment that we don't have to go through the same thing. You are supposed to rid that challenge, so we didn't have to, because the generation before you may have not had that challenge, right? And there was a time when the people who created the very laws that you uphold didn't go through those same challenges as well.
Absolutely.
It wasn't until the wars came and the issues and the problems and all of that. So is it that we're upholding this veneration for our trauma, right? That then
out
becomes
of
part of the so-called culture, which would then be holding on to the past because you went through something and almost a level of jealousy that the next generation is not going through it when they're not supposed to.
Yeah, I mean, I see that because I've had so many great mentors in my life and some not great, very harmful.
Yeah.
And that is because, you know, they had not healed their own wounds and they were coming from a place of activism or leadership that was wounded, right? That's harmful, right? But then I have some amazing, like I said, mentors and aunties, right? One of my aunties is a tribal legislator. She sits on tribal council for the Menominee Reservation, right? And she listens to me. And of course, I listen to her. I learned so much from her, right? She has way much more life experience than I have.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Right. But she honors my intelligence. She honors my thought process.
Yeah.
She's open to sit down at the table to think about different ways in which we can bring healing to our community.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about her. But that's not everybody on that council.
Yeah,
you know,
I would
and
imagine
so being able to align yourself with the elders, with the mentors who really share your beliefs, who really share your vision. Because not everybody can come where we're going.
Now, and then that kind of goes, what? Because there has to be something that says this person is ready. There has to be testing challenges. Mm-hmm. I think about the story of Sitting Bull when he was 10 years old and he went out there, right? And he touched the enemy and they knew he was one of them ones.
Yeah, he said,
right?
So.
And it's like, if there's no proving ground, that I just go through my whole life waiting for you to let me know. Where is, and how do I know that I haven't already been ready and you're just not willing to let go, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the challenge of the youth is like, you know, how do I know that I'm being upheld because the system is bad, right? Or do we actually have systems that allow us to pass the torch when the youth are ready?
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's the integrity of the leader. It's the integrity of that council. I mean, I can share an example. It's a little different, but very similar, I think. When I was getting my master's at NYU, I became a director of an urban program in New York City. It was the first time that they got this big grant. They didn't even have a location. I was like, oh my gosh, like, I'm ready. Like, we're about to build this. It's going to be everything. Like, I'm so excited. Poured everything into it. But I kept hitting a roadblock with the executive director, right? Just wouldn't listen to me. Like, slow down. You're young. You know, really kind of that misogynistic, you're a woman, you don't know as much as me, right? And I couldn't get anything done in that year. And here is all of this money sitting here in this space, and I can't do anything with it. That almost broke me, right? It's a disservice to my community. So what did I do is I left, right? And in that, I co-founded the Urban Indigenous Collective, which where it was like, okay, you're not going to let me do what I need to do and carry out this vision that I have. I'm going to do it on my own and you're going to see, you know, and shout out to him for calling me, you know, and, you know, trying to break bread and come to a better place. But I saw all of this a long time ago. Why didn't you listen? Oh, because you saw something in me that terrified you, right? It made you feel insecure about yourself. That's your work, not my stuff. Okay, I got shit to do.
Yeah. But that's the thing. People fear replacement and they fear becoming obsolete. Because at the core, human beings want value.
It's ego. Right? We're doing this for ego.
Yeah. And it's whether you are misogynistic against somebody because they're a woman or you're doing it because of their age.
Yeah.
They can be placed in the same level of bias and they create the same issues and problems.
Yes.
You know, so and that's a system I think that not just indigenous and Native American people go through. I think that that's happening all throughout the globe right now.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I believe that there's a fear that, you know, this, and I think all human beings are going through this cycle of fear of feeling obsolete, right? And not knowing what their value is going to be in the future, especially if their talents, gifts, or skills are no longer necessary. Mm-hmm. And when you look at places like Osaka, Japan, or places where people live very to an older age, these people have systems to where they take care of their elder. Right. So you don't fear not being in this position because the same level of respect and reverence will still be given to you. So whether I'm here or whether I'm there, I still have the same level of value or even more value. And I think that that's where, you know, people that are in positions of power fear that if I vacate this seat, then nobody will care about me anymore.
Well, no one wants to be discarded. But then there's also the work of realizing then that you're more than just your legacy, right? Mm-hmm. You're more than just this business that you created, right? And that's really hard for people to separate themselves from. Yeah. Their identity is based on just the work they've done or the business they created. Who am I if I'm not the CEO of this company anymore? Mm-hmm. Existential crisis. Yeah. You're still you with gifts.
Yeah.
Go pour that into the next generation or do something else with it.
Look at Joe Biden.
Give it up.
That man goddamn shit.
Give it up.
And he be speaking up there. It's like he talking at his own funeral.
Wrap it up. You feel me? Are we doing?
And I think he a representation of, like, you know, this dying system that just doesn't want to give up. He's a physical representation of it.
Yes.
And it's over, but it's like he can't see it.
I know.
Right? And I think that that's something that you have to be very careful of, knowing when your time is up in your position. And when somebody else is better fitted for it, right? And sometimes, you know, just because you're elder don't mean you're no longer fitted for it. And just because somebody's young and they got ideas don't mean they should be in there. But it's like, recognize when somebody else can serve better in your position.
Yeah,
right? Absolutely. And that could be the system of, all right, let me allow somebody else to be where I am now.
Well, that's humility.
And evolution.
So many people are lacking humility, which allows you to evolve, right? Yeah, letting go of the ego.
Yeah. So let me ask you about your spiritual systems. You know, my good sister, Queen Najdaha, had invited me to a sweat lodge.
Oh, that's my sister.
Yeah.
I was just with her.
It was hot.
It is very hot.
And dark.
Yes, it is.
You know what I'm saying? And it was spirits all around. And it was definitely a test. I wanted it to be hotter.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They act like they was trying to baby us a little bit. So next time I do a sweat lodge, I want extreme.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Sweat me out. Let me quit because I'm not going to quit. But, you know, that was a very powerful practice. And she was talking about how they have these rites of passage, mm-hmm. right? You take the young man, send him out in the forest at a certain age. He has to go forage for himself, right? Finally create his own shelter, live out there for 3 days. And it's to break this bubble of dependency and create a readiness for the world that I am now a man, right? And there was Huey P. Newton who talked about this as well. And he talked about how his family had a rites of passage. When a newborn was coming to the family, the older male would take the child out for their first walk into the sun, mm-hmm. representing, I'm going to be there to protect you in life, right? And him taking on a responsibility, sort of like a parental figure, that this is my responsibility as well. Because you have the mother and the father. You know, the father creates that skin contact with the son to create this connection. The mother has the baby come out of her womb. She's already connected, but the siblings have to then have a rites of passage to create their connection.
Yeah.
And so it had me thinking of our lack of rituals, our lack of rites, right? Mm-hmm. Our lack of spiritual codes yeah. that create the ability for us to have these systems that affect us and protect us for these seven generations.
Absolutely.
What are some of the spiritual systems, rites, or rituals or passages that you believe that may be unique to your upbringing, your cultural codes, mm-hmm. or whatsoever?
Yeah, I think for me, it's interesting that you say that this rite of passage. I didn't have any ceremony mm-hmm. like that. And I think it's really due to boarding school era. It's due to assimilation, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking about my grandma's great-grandfather, who was the first to attend Carlisle Indian boarding school, right? And her dad being a very Catholic religious man, right? My grandmother and her 14 siblings
yeah.
born on the reservation, but were born in a very Catholic religious household. My mom was born in the 70s, and thank God for my mom and growing up watching her be a part of community and running community programs for, you know, urban natives, for me to really understand how important it is to be connected to culture and ceremony, right? So a lot of my ceremony has been sweat lodge, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of it has been powwow, right? Where some of the elders will say, that's not traditional ceremony, right? But we've had to adapt as Native people to reclaim what works for us, right? To also relearn what has been erased from our mm-hmm. cultures, right? A lot of those medicine bundles mm-hmm. haven't been passed down. Mm-hmm. A lot of those sacred teachings aren't here with us, yeah. right? Because so many elders were afraid to share them, right? And then with COVID, how many elders did we lose, right? We're trying to revitalize language. We were trying to bring back tradition, right? And I think for me, what's been really helpful is receiving my name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we believe as Menominee people that you will not be able to go meet Creator and transition to spirit world if you don't have your native name, right? Mm. And that native name comes from your medicine man. And when he is preparing for that ceremony, he's going into this dream state to receive your name. And so you can say, okay, you know, your family's like, okay, we're going to get you your name. You might not get it for like 6 months, yeah. a year, a couple. It's when it comes.
What's
right?
your native name?
Noctow Pianuki.
Noctow Pianuki.
Noctow Pianuki.
Noctow Pianuki.
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Comes first woman.
Comes first woman.
Yeah.
That's mm-hmm. fire.
So I think that right there was this, not a coming of age, but coming into my indigeneity and this other level, right? Growing up, I grew up dancing in the powwow circle. You know, I was a jingle dress dancer, and that dress brings healing to those who are sick in our community. Mm. I didn't know that when I was like 2-3 years old yeah. running around there, but I knew that that was the dance that I wanted to do. I knew that was the regalia that yeah, I wanted to wear, you know? So yeah, I think again, it's just, someone shared something to me the other day. They were telling me about how they were used to work at this community center in Minnesota, right? And this Native woman came in and said to this other Native woman, can you teach me how to make a dream catcher? And she was like, I don't know how to make a dream catcher. Like, what? Like, I know I'm Native, but I don't know how to make that.
Yeah.
And she was like, we are, because we're Native, because we know or we're indigenous, there's just kind of misconception that we know all of the traditions and cultural things and protocols.
Well, yeah.
We're not born knowing them all, right?
Yeah.
So many of us are relearning, right? Because we had grandparents who were scared to go to ceremony. My grandmother, couple years ago, I asked her about powwow. I was like, Grandma, you never go to powwow. Like, you know, and she said, I never went to powwow. I wasn't allowed to. Mm. And I was like, what? And then I had to remember, oh, it was illegal.
Yeah.
Right? We didn't have the right to be in powwow, practice our ceremonial ways, sit with our traditional medicines until the 1970s, right? Mm. Through the American Indian Religious Freedom Act, it was the first time we were granted the legal right to have a relationship with Creator in our way. How crazy is that, right? Mm. And it wasn't until like 1993 that then the peyote was allowed to come into that play also, right? So I think, you know, for a lot of us younger generation Indigenous peoples, right, it's a lot about like relearning, unlearning, reclaiming, and figuring out what works for us.
Yeah, because you know what? Native Americans got so many dope things, though.
Yeah, we do.
You know what I mean? I was going through the other week, and I started discovering all these Native American musicians and singers hip-hop artists, and they were raw, though.
Oh, yeah.
And then they got the thing where they speak from the throat, so it'd be like, but it's, and I'm not giving it justice, but...
Well, if you know Queen Yahajna, she was bringing, you know, mad Native hip-hop artists to New York City. We had the pleasure of hosting them, you know, at the Urban Indigenous Collective. But there's so many great talents and so many gems within Indigenous communities. And because of the erasure, because of the disconnection, you know, we lack visibility. Mm-hmm. But I think with social media, we're starting to see more of that visibility. Yeah. And a lot of us are coming into urban spaces where, like New York City, we have one of the largest populations of urban natives in the country, right? But we haven't until, you know, some of us new trailblazers have, you know, taken a seat and said, okay, like we're going to create a space for us.
Yeah.
But creating a space for us to be able to recognize all the talent, all the voices, all the strategy, thinkers, innovators, so that we can like make some things happen here.
Yeah, I would love to connect more with a lot of Native American people and learn more.
Yeah.
Right? You know, I can sometimes be a bulldozer. You know, you walk into a room. So I don't know. You might not know what's respectful, what's sacred, what's all of these different ways. So, you know, but I'm always willing to learn.
Well,
you feel me?
That's all you need. And when you don't know, ask, you know? And that's humility. That's it.
Because I believe that there's a lot of Black people in America that I think naturally register with a lot of Native American spirit. And then there are some who naturally register with African spirituality.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, my younger brother, he got his wolf tribe thing he got going on. And I believe he has a real, if I was to look at him, he has much more of a Native American spirit than an African spirit.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Just in his regalia and his music and his representation. And I don't think it's something that he tries to do. I just think it's a natural thing that you can see. But we haven't, you know, dug deep into our genealogy to study that. Even on my father's side, he spoke about it. But it's
well,
like
you need to do that. Let me stop.
We will.
Because
we will.
What
we
is
will.
A tree without its roots?
That's going to be in my next 19 minutes.
Okay, I'm gonna tune in because
that's surely
so important. How can you heal your, you know, historical or intergenerational trauma if you don't know all your ancestors?
Yeah.
How can you recognize all your gifts if you don't know all the ancestors, all the grandmothers, all the grandfathers you came from?
Yeah.
You know, and it's hard. But also being Black, you know, and I identify with this as well. I can trace all my ancestors back on the Native side.
But you know, sometimes we can't trace our ancestors because our ancestors killed some white men and they disappeared. And
that's
then that trail stopped. So sometimes it just represents we one of the ones. You know what I'm talking about?
You know, you can connect with them through prayer and through ceremony.
No, I'll connect to
that
all
plant
the
medicine.
All of the, none of my ancestors were suckers. That's the thing.
That's right.
You know, we come from a long lineage of killers. You feel me? The warrior type. You feel me? That's why I registered. Like, what registers in my spirit is John Horse. You know, I love his story because, and I bring it up a lot, but he fought for his freedom so many times. You know, he fought, you know, for America, against America, with the Native Americans against America, right? He was a slave within the Native Americans, a different system, and then he was a slave in America. Right? He thought he got his freedom going to Florida, and then they reneged on that. He had to fight again, then ultimately end up going to Mexico. Then had to fight some more. And it's like the average person doesn't even know his story. But his story is a connection between the Native American and the African, right? There were so many families that was being, you know, birthed, right, from those unions.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just a history we don't even dwell in at all.
At all.
So when we talk about repatriation and connection to Africa without even diving into our history here in America.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You got to go back to the wars.
Yeah, deep interconnection, so much intersectionality, right? And I think even when we think about like honorary natives, mm-hmm. right, with the freedmen's, right, and how they became native because, you know, they were slaves of that tribe. Mm-hmm. And then when slavery was outlawed, allegedly, at that time, they said, okay, we're going to make you honorary natives. Mm-hmm. So you have this whole line of folks who are Black,
well,
who
yeah.
are enrolled in a federally recognized tribe and have the same federal status as any other Native person, right? But yeah, I think no one talks about
this. It was a lot of trickery in those. It was a lot of trickery, you know.
The biggest tricksters, aren't they?
Hell yeah. I mean, you know, they just came out with the movie of Way of the Flower Moon. Is that yes. called, is what it's called?
Yes.
But that shows you, I think it just shows you, number one, the greed of America, but the history yes. that we don't speak upon, but it's such a deep reality. And so, of course, people want to move over the past, but you can't because the past makes some people feel guilty. Because
well,
they are.
Let them feel guilty, but that's why it's so important when we have movies like Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yeah, Killers of the Flower
right?
Moon.
Right? And we have allies like Leonardo DiCaprio who okay. aren't going to try to play this white savior
yeah.
in the movie. He's going to play the villain, right? Yeah. And he's going to back this, right? And I think it's so important when.
So he backed that movie, you said?
Yeah, you know, and he has backed so many different movies that really center indigenous stories, right? That need to be told. And yeah, I'm sure it made a lot of people uncomfortable. We were invited to the premiere and, mm-hmm. you know, it was really great to be there. But, you know, we have to move through that uncomfortability and have uncomfortable dialogue so that we can heal. This is the restorative justice, right? This is how we move forward. We can't just keep it under the rug. And mm-hmm. that's what a lot of our, you know, ancestors and grandparents did. Like, we just don't talk about it. We're just going to keep going. We're just going to leave it over here, though.
And it's interesting because in reality, the only people that I see we have anything in common with is Native American people. Everybody else, you can compare your struggles and history. It's not the same mm-hmm. because you are perpetuators and oppressors in our struggle as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't get to have alliance, mm-hmm. you know, when you are part of the oppression.
That's right.
You know what I mean? Even when we look at that movie, you see, you know, the men who were a part of it. It was white men. It was Jewish men. Mm-hmm. And this is a history we shouldn't have to get through Hollywood cinema. You know what I'm saying? Like,
should be just taught in schools, right?
Yeah,
start with the education system.
But we know the education system is to create a narrative for people to follow.
Of course.
Or not to actually give us true history. And this is where you can go big Florida and the school systems to teach you mm-hmm. proper history. Or we can cipher amongst ourselves and get that, because that's what we're supposed to do.
Open source.
The moment that you believe the government is supposed to do your job, right, then you have to go along with the quality of the way they do their job.
Yeah, and even thinking of the government's here to help us.
No, like, that ain't their job.
That's their job. It's to keep us where they want us to be. It's to keep us complacent. It's to keep us sheep. You know, they try to little dog us.
Yeah, but we're big dogs.
That's right. That's
so
right.
So let me get into this last point about your advocacy, right? Can you explain to us some of the history of your advocacy and some of the future of it and some things that you would like to bring more exposure to?
Yeah. So, you know, I think I found my voice as an activist when I was 17 years mm-hmm. old. In inner city Milwaukee, I was a part of something called Urban Underground.
Okay.
So Reggie Moore and Charlene Moore, they're my activist parents, but they brought inner city youth together to really identify who were the leaders of the community, right? So it was a whole application process of like 800, right? And I became part of the cohort, and they taught us how to, you know, use our voices. I always say they knew I had a voice before I did, you know? And they helped cultivate it, right? They taught us how to create social justice campaigns and organize. And I just owe so much to them because they saw something in me that I didn't have the power to recognize at that moment. But from then, you know, I dreamt so big, you know. Before that, you know, my mindset was so small. I'm just going to stay in Wisconsin and be here, and I'm just going to be a therapist. And
yeah.
the world was at my fingertips, right? It was the first time second time I got on a plane and I went to DC. They took me to DC for a conference and I went to Harvard University and I just got to see the world in such a different light, right? But I moved to New York City when I was 18 years old, so-called New York, right? We call it Lenape Hoking or Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And really wanted to just better understand the historical and intergenerational trauma of my family and what I was experiencing. So I pursued a degree in psychology. The beginning of my career was really doing a lot of research, looking at like acculturation, right? When you're navigating two cultures in this dominant white society, how that impacts your mental health and your academic performance, and how we need these culturally appropriate modalities in school and in healthcare and in business to really be able to thrive, right? We can prove that. We know that. Right. And then early in my career, I really started looking at like innovative technologies, like how can we use the tools of technology to support the social justice causes we care about, right? So I work for a startup called Cognito, and I helped to create one of the first culturally tailored simulations that trained law enforcement how to engage with Native youth without re-traumatizing them. Mm-hmm. So being able to teach them motivational interviewing skills and techniques and de-escalation skills, and also suicide prevention technologies for teachers to be able to recognize these like psychological markers that could indicate that a student is in distress. And how do we have those difficult conversations that can be taboo for some people, right? Mm-hmm. So that was my beginning. And then I really came into this role as a director of an urban program, right? And saw just this opportunity and need for my community to really be able to have this hub where we can bring our thoughts and prayers and traditions and arts in one place, right? But was feeling really limited in that, right? As a survivor of gender-based violence and having a relative that's a missing and murdered Indigenous woman, Ingrid Washington Wittock, Flying Eagle Woman, I became really passionate about this MMIP movement. So if you've seen the red hand over the face, that's that movement. And really recognized that they weren't counting us in data in New York City. You know, we were getting lumped with other. And I'm like, how am I as a community member, right, supposed to be able to advocate for my community if I don't understand what the data is, right? What's the scope of violence? What's happening? So really decided to launch the Urban Indigenous Collective in 2019 with one of my co-founders, Errol Richard, and another co-founder, Jared Packard. Errol Richard is Afro-Indigenous by way of Carib Indian. She's Venezuelan in Trinidad and Tobago. And then Jared Packard is Oglala Lakota. And we were just these young, hungry, you know, grad students who really were just seeing just this gap within New York City. So decided to launch on Indigenous Peoples Day on Randall's Island, 2019. Did not see this pandemic coming, but launched with the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, Girls, Trans, and Two-Spirit program. So we have filed over 120 Freedom of Information Act requests with law enforcement to demand the data of our loved ones, of our relatives, of our kin, to really be able to understand what is happening, right? There's this misconception that, you know, this violence against Indigenous women or people is only happening on reservations. But that's not true. Urban places are just not tracking the data. Mm. I'm a lived experience. My relative Ingrid is a lived experience who lived in Brooklyn, right? So really being able to organize in that way. So tracking the data, we have an unprecedented policy tracker where we track all of the policy and legislation throughout the United States mm-hmm. with the interactive map to understand, you know, where that policy is and how we can influence it. We do a lot of work in mentorship. So young Indigenous women who come to New York City to attain higher education, we support them with stipends, we pay for their Wi-Fi, we pay for their food cards every week, we pair them with mentors, we give them individualized curriculums to help them be able to survive in a place like New York City. Mm. So we've got, you know, MOUs with Columbia University, NYU, where they bring their Indigenous students to us. So it's like this incubator that we have.
Yeah.
A lot of community-based participatory research. I mean, we're really passionate about that data aspect because how can we really understand what's happening if we're not being in consultation with our community? So everything that we have built and scaled has been in consultation with this ongoing surveys and qualitative focus groups, right? What we just call storytelling, right? Mm-hmm. But in the Western academia, you know, qualitative research. But this really helps inform what we're building so we can be strategic, because I just really think you can't scale a business or a movement based on your own assumptions. It has to be grounded in community consensus, right? That's the seven generations. That's kinship, right? That's what the Haudenosaunee has shown us, right? And in that, we've been able to scale in an amazing way in 4 years. So I'm really excited that we just opened up our community center in Midtown Manhattan on 39th and 8th. So when you're in New York City next, absolutely, you got to come check us out. Absolutely. We would be honored to have you. Yeah.
First of all, respect for all the work that you do.
Thank you.
And all the work that you will do.
Thank you.
Right. It sounds like you are a true gem to your people, and you are on square and living on purpose. Mm. You know, it had me thinking as you were talking about innovative technologies.
Mm.
When we think about Africa a lot, mm-hmm, and we think about infrastructure that can be built on Africa specifically because there's a lot of third world infrastructure there, mm-hmm, there's a great opportunity because they don't have to rip down any existing infrastructure, so they can start with top line technology, right? Most of when we come in America, most of the design, architecture, the technology is of the past.
Yeah.
Right? And you can kind of date it to when it was invented, and we're still using the same thing.
That's right.
We're not using technology that is of the highest level of human innovation.
No, I think about New York City train systems, how old and decrepit
old
is.
As hell.
Then I went to China for a month, and I'm on bullet trains, and I'm in between cities in like minutes.
No, I just came from the CES show about all of the different technologies, and it was mind-blowing.
Yeah.
But you realize that America couldn't transition that fast into new technology because they will have to spend all the money getting rid of current technology and infrastructure.
Because they're only thinking short term. Long term, it's so much more beneficial and sustainable, right?
Yeah.
They can't get past that, right? As visionaries, we can see into the future. Mm-hmm. They can't.
But to that point, though, I believe Native Americans and Africans are in a unique position because they haven't built, right? So now you can start with top of the line technology, cities, and anything that you want to build. And it would be far more impressive and greater than the existing systems and or cities. So it's like, it's almost got to this point where it was a gift, where it's like you kind of waited till technology got to a peak, right? And then you say, okay, now we'll start building.
Yeah.
Right? So that means that the land that the Native Americans own and the continent of Africa and the different countries can start building the future cities of the world.
Yes.
And I believe that's truly the pathway of where we should be at right now. And if there should be a greater bridge, number one, because as Black Americans, we think about, you know, what is our role in the world? And we have a great role. We are the influencers of social justice, you know, and the fight for equality and freedom and liberation all across the planet Earth.
Yeah.
But also we have a particular skill set and know-how, right? Yeah. Because we've been in this world, right? If we go over to America, to Africa, the best thing is, you know, what can we help build over there?
Well, right? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been so amazed. So I'm an MIT fellow.
Mm-hmm.
We have founded a company called Chalk Talk that connects Native users to Indigenous therapists, leveraging AI, Calendly, Zoom, a unique stack deck, right? And in that fellowship and in that cohort, I got to see so many Indigenous entrepreneurs, right, and visionaries that are creating amazing, innovative technology for so many different avenues, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're absolutely correct. When I was able to create that culturally tailored simulation back in 2015, I think that was, right? It was right after I graduated with my bachelor's. This was the first time this innovative technology had come to Indian country, right? But these training simulations have been making their rounds in white America, right? Teaching teachers how to have, like, you know, these difficult conversations with suicidal ideation, right? But why is it that Native people, you know, and Black people are the last to receive the innovative technology to be able to heal, right? But I think, you know, when we're talking about infrastructure, absolutely, what it's going to need, what it's going to require is education, right? Mm-hmm. Coming into the communities and being able to share our vision, right?
Yeah.
So that they can get, you know, on the same frequency, because it can seem scary if they don't understand something, because for elders, things are moving so fast and they're like, what? VR, MetaQuest, crypto? Like, oh my gosh, right?
So it's is funny because all this stuff really has already been around.
It has.
And it's really, when you think about the people, and here's, I think a lot of the fear comes from, like, when I went to CES, I only see like 24 black people out of tens of thousands of people. This is their largest conference, right? And so a lot of the fear comes from our ignorance, right? And it's like, it's not the technology we fear, right? The technology will do what we say.
Yeah.
If we build it and we design it and we code it.
Yeah.
And it's
we're
like,
oh, creators.
Yeah. We really fear not executing.
Yes.
You know what I mean? We fear not being involved. And so, you know, that is the challenge of getting over that fear to get started. You're going to see billionaires build new cities.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be easier to build a new city than rip out an old city and give new technology.
Yeah, they're calling it conscious communities. I was at the World Economic Forum and I spoke there and I could not, the theme that I was coming across in my conversations, right? I just wanted to talk to as many people as I could. Is this conscious community that they're building, these islands and this land. And, you know, they've got these plans and they've got the investors to do it. And that's the one thing I'd say is like, yes, you know, tribes have the land. Some tribes are much richer than others, right? Because of casinos or the way they diversify their portfolio, right? And their economic investments. But for many, we need people to step in, right? So it's not only education that I think is lacking, but it's also the economic investment that's necessary, right? Because we've had to rely on the government so much, right?
And I think there's, and even we know this as Black people, there's a lack of communication and outreach, right? We don't have large scale conversations. You talk about WEF, right? You go to Davos, they talk about how to run the world, right? Problems of the world. But when do we sit together and we say, okay, let's have a conversation between the scientists and the engineers of our culture, right? Let's bring all the native and indigenous, you know, engineers, scientists, architects, things of that nature, and have a round table and discuss this in front of the rest of the tribes.
No, right? I agree.
Like,
I
that's
agree.
The goal is to take their systems, create our own so we can build what we want.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. And it's not replicating it, right? Because not everything is a one size fit all. But how do we culturally tailor in a way that feels in alignment for us? And I think that's like so true because so many conferences that I go to, I'm like, okay, great. I'm learning so much. Knowledge exchange is happening.
Yeah.
Silos are breaking down. Great. Because I get to meet people I would have never got the pleasure of meeting if I would have stayed in my room. Right. But what are we doing after this? Because what are we doing? How do we stay accountable? Like, what are we doing? What are we creating? What are the spaces? And this is happening, what, every 6 months, every year, where we're tracking it, you know, what we see within the United Nations. But so bureaucratic, things move so slow. So I think we're really in need of something like that, a space like that.
Yeah, but that's why it's almost like you just got to, but like yourself, you just got to do it. And
just
like,
it.
Respectfully, I'm just going to do it.
Yeah, well, that's
it. And then you got to like it or not afterwards.
Some people don't like me and some elders, you know.
But I don't, the goal is not to be liked.
That's it. I'm doing the work that feels in alignment. Yeah. And if I can wake up with myself and feel gratitude and at peace in my heart, then that's it.
Well, then think about the elders might not like you, but their children will love you.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we don't have with the Urban Indigenous Collective, the kids love us.
Yeah.
the kids love us.
And that's not even just a message to Indigenous people. That's a message to all people around the world that are dealing with that same struggle.
That's right.
You can't ask for permission. You got to go on a mission. You just got to do it.
Listen to the kids.
I believe we in a time of do or die. If you don't do it now, you know, it's like you become your own oppressor at this point.
That's right.
Right? Your lack of pushing that button and going is the oppressor today.
Yeah,
your fear
time.
Is the oppressor.
Yeah.
If you got the land or whether you got the resources or you're not willing to create connections or outlook or outreach and communicate with people to leverage what you have to build, the excuses always going to be there. Some of us have no resources at all.
That's right.
You know what I mean? Others have resources. So you have to start with where you are, right? And so, you know, I know a few of the sisters, you know, that are doing things and they just go for it. You feel me? And that's the message that I think ultimately I would love this conversation to be about. Like, what does the future? And a young brother asked me this today. He was like, how do we impregnate the people with the ideas of the future? I'm like, first of all, plan it out to a T. You know, create, most of the time when a person want to build a city, they create a model city first, right? Show people the model city, how it works.
Yeah.
We don't do enough of that. right? We don't do enough brainstorming and coming together and say, this is the future we want to build. Now you get to deny it, but you're denying the future. You want to keep what's here or you want to build this? Well, yeah. You force people's hands when you give a vision to a people, and then the people become dissatisfied with those who are in the way of the vision being brought out. So that's sort of the strategy right now.
Yeah, well, one, there's never a right time to start. There's always going to be things that happen, variables that we can't control. You just got
to
go.
There's a right time to start.
Well, you just got
to
go. So now. You mean, like, you can't wait. Like, you're going to keep bringing excuses on why it has to be later, or you need this, or you need that. You just got to go, right?
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, I mean, we're in a really interesting time where, like you said, people are too scared to start. To the fact that we don't even have a pilot or a model. And that is what's so beautiful about entrepreneurship is that, like, you create an innovative idea and there is multiple iterations and there are so many moments where you have to pivot, and all of that is okay because it's never been done before what you're creating. And I think that's the humility to say, okay, we haven't done this, but we're just going to do it because it's needed. And that's what I saw with the Urban Indigenous Collective, right? There was nobody doing exactly what we were doing in the way we were doing it and the way we were thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And is it what it was 4 years ago? No, because it's evolved, right? It's breathing on its own. It's walking on its own. And there's so many different pivots and iterations, and being able to be flexible and allow that movement to happen is what has allowed us to scale in the way we have in four years, right? So I think, yeah, like, let's just do it and figure it out as we go. Like, that's the energy. Like, I need that type of energy. Let's just do it.
Well, thank you. This is 19 Minutes with 19 Keys. May y'all stay tapped in. Thank you very much.
Matchwa Wainan, a big thank you.
I got a question for you. What does your cabinet look like? What is it that you're taking into your routine that's keeping you high level? If it's not our products, then whose products are you taking? And if it's no products, then that's a problem. Y'all seen our commercial for Goldwater, right? You've seen it all over high level conversations. You come to the show, you grab you a bottle, people give us the best testimonials on the planet, and we got people on the go. The thing about Goldwater is, it's not our only product. We have products like the vitamin C moss. We don't naturally produce vitamin C, so we got to get it in other forms. So therefore, especially during wintertime, we are able to keep that immune system functioning high. And let's say if you just want pure moss. This is just pure moss. I'm talking about a superfood, the best on the planet. And not just from anywhere, because you never know where people actually getting their moss from. I ain't never seen them take a trip to Jamaica. See, we get ours tested, right, to make sure that you're getting the highest quality, pure version of it, and you're getting those minerals in an over-chemicalized world. We got Smart Moss Gold, right? That Smart Moss Gold is like a Viagra for the brain. You ever find yourself where your brain feels like it's low? You tap one of these and your brain gonna feel high level. Yeah, and women love a sapiosexual, so when those brains are popping and those ideas are ready, you stay tapped in. You gotta make sure you stay safe out here. It's all sort of viruses and diseases that's running around this world, especially during this time. If you're traveling, make sure you spray this on the orifices throughout your body to kill any of those viruses or any of those things trying to invade you. Make sure y'all tap into goldwater.com so next time somebody asks you, what's keeping you high level? What's keeping you young and healthy and wealthy feeling? And now we can take some of that credit for it over here at goldwater.com. Make sure you keep your health journey running. It's a marathon. Peace.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio.
See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.